Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is not often the case that we recognize the nature of the war, sometimes right here in America. We talk about it a good bit on this program, but we haven't spoken for some time with a woman who has been waging an important battle in this, well, home front fight. Her name is Elizabeth Yore. She is a highly regarded international human rights lawyer. She has specialized in matters like human trafficking and child abuse, and has made a particular effort in recent years to work on an issue that, well, involves both of those and a whole litany of other horrors. It's called female genital mutilation, and she has founded an organization to work it and try to prevent it from happening in our country, which does occur. It's called End FGM Today. And I just got a release about an important sort of moment in this battle in the state of Maine, and wanted to catch up with Liz Yore to visit with her about what's going on there and more generally across the country. Liz, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you. You've done such amazing work, Liz, and I think when we last talked, it's been a while, I'm sorry to say, about this, there were some 20 states that had no protections for their female population against this scourge. I see in the release that it's now down to 11, but the state of Maine is one of the 11 that has yet to enact protection. Talk about what's going on in Maine and who is responsible for perhaps them remaining at great risk.
As you know, we have been battling Maine for well over 2 years to get an FGM bill, criminal bill passed in Maine. And what is extremely troubling, Frank, is, you know, in my view, in the view of victims of FGM who have testified before the Maine legislature, is that this is child abuse that lasts a lifetime, causing physical and emotional trauma that lasts a lifetime. Maine is especially concerning to us and shocking that the bill has not passed, because Maine has one of the highest Somali immigrant populations. And what we now know, Frank, is that when immigrants come from FGM practicing countries, they continue this practice. And over 97% of women and girls in Somalia are subjected to this hideous and barbaric practice. And so without a federal criminal law prohibiting FGM, it has now fallen on the state, even more so, to pass FGM criminal legislation. And shockingly, Maine, according to the CDC, has over 1,600, almost 1,700 women and girls at risk of female genital mutilation. And we know from the immigrant-serving NGOs that it is ongoing in Maine. And yet, Frank, I mean, this should not come as a surprise to people after the hypocrisy of the Me Too movement. The House Speaker, Sarah Gideon, who is a Democrat, has been leading the charge. She's a feminist, has been leading the charge, not for the FGM bill, but against it. And she has been very vociferous, organizing her party according to party lines, to defeat this bill. And she has been the main obstruction to this important FGM legislation in Maine. And this is why feminists need to understand, as we learn from domestic violence, Frank, as we learn from human trafficking, these immigrant women, these vulnerable children, need laws to protect them. This is about empowering women. And Sarah Gideon simply dismisses it by saying the bill was racist towards Maine Somali immigrant community and population. And my response is that these women and little girls deserve the protection of this law to prevent them from being abused. And basically, Sarah Gideon is saying, no, they can continue this abuse and not make it a crime in Maine.
And the reason this issue has taken on such urgency, as you know so well, Liz Ure, is it is happening in our country. And a federal judge who was asked to rule on a case in which the federal government had brought charges against a doctor for conducting these kinds of, two doctors, I guess, for conducting these kinds of mutilations, he decided rather than rule on the case, he would strike down the federal law on which under which those charges were brought. So it falls to the states to provide this protection. It's really the only hope these women and children have to be spared a lifetime, as you say, of psychological torment as well as terrible physical trauma as well. And it would seem to me this ought to be an issue in the Senate race. If this woman seeks higher office, she has to be called out for what she's done to leave, as you say, nearly 1,700 women and children in her own state at grave risk of this kind of trauma.
Frank, I frankly feel that Sarah Gideon is allowing Maine to be a safe harbor for FGM mutilators. And to me, this is heinous. And it also suggests to me that the Me Too movement is not really interested in protecting immigrant women and girls. What, are they not entitled to the protection due process laws in this country? And they're allowed to suffer in silence. You know, the CDC, and this is now a study that's over 5 years old, said 513,000 women and girls in the United States are at risk of having FGM imposed on them. And in my opinion, it is the responsibility of legislators to pass criminal laws in every state. And I believe that Sarah Gideon has to certainly respond to this issue. To me, she is being negligent. I frankly think it's racist to say that little girls and women, immigrants from Somalia, aren't entitled to protection, that they can continue violent, brutal procedures when they come to the United States. And so to me, this is a number one issue that the Maine voters should really put her on the hot seat, because Frank, she put her name, her power, and everything on the line to defeat this legislation.
Liz, we are out of time. It's critical that all of Lebanon, these states, bring these kinds of laws to bear. And I appreciate so much your leadership at End FGM Now. It's a critically important mission, and we appreciate so much your leadership in it. Come back to us again with updates if you would. Liz Ure, thank you. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about the latest developments in China and what they mean for us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with one of our great guests, Gordon G. Chang. You can follow him at that handle, Gordon G. Chang, on Twitter. You can also follow him in places like Fox News and The Daily Beast, National Interest, and countless other outlets, because he is regarded, I think, universally as one of our country's great experts on China, very much a topic on people's minds at the moment, as it should be. He's the author of several important books, including The Coming Collapse of China. Gordon Chang, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back. Gordon, you have a new piece out at the Gatestone Institute, where you're a senior fellow, and you have rebutted former Secretary of State George Shultz's contention in the Wall Street Journal recently that we really need to accommodate China. You don't think so? Why not?
Well, because China's a militant state that denies the legitimacy of the United States, denies our right to exist, committing crimes against humanity, trying to dismember its neighbors, spreading disease around the world. I mean, the list continues. George Shultz, who served the U.S. with great distinction in the Nixon and Reagan administrations, has that op-ed that you mentioned in the Thursday Wall Street Journal print edition. And he makes the argument that we should try to accommodate China, which is an argument that is the majority view. And in it, he talks about off-ramps, that we should be trying to develop off-ramps for China. And that's understandable as well. But the problem is, he talks about, for instance, agreements avoiding conflict at sea or in the air due to unplanned encounters. We've tried that before with the 2014 agreement, the Code on Unplanned Encounters, which has been a total failure. And the reason it's a failure is that these encounters are not unplanned. They are perfectly planned. They're premeditated by China. When China wants a crisis, it creates it. No code, agreement, treaty, or whatever is going to prevent China's state from doing that. So we've got to understand that this is the nature of the Chinese state to create conflict. And so for us, in the first instance, it's for us to deter it. But in a larger sense, we have to realize that there is no accommodation with China. We cannot coexist with the People's Republic of China. And so therefore, our goal has got to be to protect ourselves, to end Communist Party rule.
You know, Gordon, this reminds me of the old adage, the enemy gets a vote. It's not enough for us to want to engage China. They have to be desirous of engagement on some terms other than our submission. And that doesn't seem to be in prospect at the moment. It also raises the point that I wonder, Gordon, whether George Shultz's pro-engagement notion is in fact any longer the majority view. I think it certainly is probably among the elites, but I seriously doubt, based on polls our Committee on the Present Danger China and others have taken, especially with the coronavirus, that that's no longer widely embraced by the American people. What do you think?
Yeah, if you consider the American people as a whole, I agree with you, and your polls show that. Among the policymakers, among elites, clearly they still want, of course, to accommodate China. They still believe that we can work together, that we can somehow find a way to coexist. And that's a nice feeling, you know. Everyone would like that, but the problem is you understand the nature of the regime. And this goes back, of course, to the 1970s when you had Nixon and Kissinger with detente policies, believing that the Soviet Union was much stronger than the United States and that we had to find some way to live with it. Reagan came along and said, no, they're weak and we are going to win. And that's the attitude that we need right now with China, because China is far more dangerous than the Soviet Union was in the 1980s. And so, therefore, we have got to find some way to protect ourselves, not to live with China. So we can't accommodate it. As just as you say, it's not up to us. It's up to the Chinese, and they've made it very, very clear that they do not want to accommodate us.
Gordon, you just mentioned that China is a far more formidable foe than the Soviet Union was in its heyday. I agree with that. It certainly is a far more serious problem than is Russia. And that's true, especially, I think, with respect to the efforts that the Chinese are now making very explicitly, very brazenly, to interfere with our elections, to seek, in their view, the defeat of Donald Trump and the election of Joe Biden as our next president. We're hearing once again talk that the Russians are involved in our election and are meddling on behalf of Donald Trump. I'm not sure what the evidence of that is, but it certainly seems to pale by comparison, does it not? And shouldn't that really be another indicator that George Shultz has got it wrong, and we cannot possibly be in a position where we are sort of turning a blind eye to such behavior?
China is very much involved in this election cycle. You know, we see it in a number of different ways. So, for instance, their public disinformation campaigns this year. There's two of them of note, one of them about the coronavirus, the other about the George Floyd protests. But also their troll farm operations, which are extensive, far larger than Russia's. So, for instance, just to give you one metric, in June, Twitter took down 174,000 fake Chinese accounts. That's one social media company in 1 month. And we have seen especially recently, renewed effort to replace those accounts and to influence the election. And we know that they're working in favor of the Democratic candidate because they were working in his favor, Biden's favor, over Sanders during the Democratic primaries. And now they are working to unseat the president of the United States. I think that this is largely out of desperation because I see China right now, its leaders striking out and lashing out in ways which are extremely dangerous and indicate fundamental weakness. But whether they're weak or strong, whatever their motivation, they are making it very clear that they are going to try to win the election. One other thing, Frank. We know that South Korea's President Moon Jae-in enlisted the help of the Communist Party, Huawei Technologies, and possibly Tencent, the internet giant, in developing an algorithm to steal the April 15th National Assembly election. They were successful in doing that. They were switching votes in the middle of voting in ways that was most beneficial for them and the hardest to detect. I'm concerned that if we've got any sort of Chinese involvement in our backbone, our election backbone, that they'll try and do the same thing here through electronic voting machines. This is something that we need to pay attention to between now and November 3, obviously, because China could be involved not just in trying to sway opinion, but also in switching votes.
Let me ask you about one other piece of this, Gordon. You touched on it. There have been reports that there was considerable pushback against Xi Jinping, the president or general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, during the recent leadership retreat. I believe they call it Beidahai. Talk a little bit about what we know about his standing in the party at the moment and his hold on power.
Yeah, you're referring to the Beidahai Leadership Conference, which occurs most August at the seaside resort of that name. We know very little of what the result is. We do know that preceding it there and actually during the course of the conference, there were a number of senior Communist Party voices criticizing Xi Jinping in very strident terms, which is an indication of factional struggle in the leadership. There's problems between Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang, the premier. Li Keqiang has sort of disappeared from view, leading to all sorts of speculation. So right now, there's a lot of signals, but we don't really know what it means. You know, one thing that is occurring is this purge of security officials. That would indicate that Xi Jinping needs a purge, but on the other hand, is strong enough to do it. So we're going to need some time before we can fully understand what is occurring in July and August, and indeed, will it continue to occur?
One of the things that we've often talked about, Gordon, on this program and elsewhere, has been the possibility that, especially if there is weakness within his party leadership, that this may be a moment when Xi decides to opt for the authoritarian's, you know, sort of emergency measure of what's called social engineering, creating some kind of external crisis, some enemy that has to be contended with, and the people and the party must rally around the leader. Is that something that you think is a particular danger at the moment?
Yeah, I think that it certainly is, Frank. And the reason is that when you start looking at the situation in China, it really is quite desperate from an objective point of view. So, for instance, you have the effects of coronavirus on the economy, which was already stagnating before the disease, but obviously has created disruptions and contractions. Also, there are the severe flooding, the other diseases like the armyworm. So there clearly is disruptions there. Also, there are long-term problems that China can't solve. So, for instance, it is entering a period of accelerated demographic decline, which will last throughout this century. We are seeing an exhausted environment, which despite the flooding is affected by the scarcity of water, something that Chinese leaders have never been able to deal with, at least in the People's Republic. So you start to put all these crises together, and there are a few others, and it must mean that Xi Jinping and other senior leaders see a closing window of opportunity. That may be one explanation why we have seen some very belligerent behavior this year, especially beginning in February. It's very hard to ascribe motives for what the Chinese leaders do, but nonetheless, this must be weighing on their mind.
Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you very much for your time today, as always, and for your great clarity on these issues, among other places, the Gatestone Institute. Again, follow Gordon at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with John Perry about a particularly problematic Chinese corporate effort to dominate our drone market, what it might mean for all of us. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and visiting for the first time, I believe, on Secure Freedom Radio with John Perry. He is the co-founder of an important company called Altavian, on whose board he currently serves as its chairman, which has been very much at the cutting edge of America's drone technology. And I caught up with him a week or so ago about what has been happening in that industry here in the United States, and really some very ominous things that it portends for, well, our privacy, for one thing, our intellectual property, our security, for that matter. A real delight to be able to welcome John Perry to our microphones. John, thank you so much for taking some time with us. Talk a little bit about the nature of the industry today and the role that a Chinese company called DJI is currently playing in our drone market and what it means for users.
Absolutely. I think a great place to start is back in actually June 2019, when President Trump actually invoked the Defense Production Act with a presidential directive designating small unmanned aircraft systems, or most people know them as drones, as critical to the national defense. And that was really an act that culminated over a decade of realization and growing concern within the government about China's dominance of this technology area. You know, drones are something that present a broad range of threats. It is a dual-use technology. Most people know drones, flying in their backyards. I'm sure most have a neighbor that's been in the hobby, and they use them to collect video for parties and weddings and promotional video for real estate, et cetera. But it's important to understand that those capabilities also have a dual use side in the military for things like intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance. And in fact, our military has been using drones actively for several decades now. What's changed is that since the mid-2000s, China really recognized the direction of this technology development, incorporated it as part of what became its Made in China 2025 plan, and really focused on their technology base and their industry, not only taking the lead, but taking control of drone technology.
And this is very much consistent with sort of the predatory trade practices of China in all kinds of other industry sectors where they've decided they want to be dominant. And they basically have driven their competitors, including American companies, more or less out of the business. Is that right?
Well, that's correct. And it hasn't been an isolated effort. It's actually been a very broad effort. So beyond the usual trade practices where China unfairly provides direct subsidy to their domestic industry with massive investments to their production capability and R&D investments, they have also engaged with unfair trade practices such as misclassification of imports. So some of the critical drone technologies being classified as toys instead of aerospace technology, for example, thereby avoiding typical tariffs. They have collaborated closely with Silicon Valley and And it's very interesting, even where American capital has gone to work in the drone industry, it has largely been in support of the model where China is the source and principal in the production and development of the drones. Finally, sort of the third leg of this has been China's very intense and direct influence and engagement with our regulatory policy. So with the FAA in developing policies that are friendly to their industry and are quite destructive to the domestic industry.
So you've mentioned that these are dual use. One other use that they can be put to, of course, is as a weapons delivery system. We've seen ISIS using them for that purpose in various places. It's a poor man's cruise missile, I guess one might say. But how else can these drones be used to harm the interests and personal equities, I guess one might say, of American citizens?
Yes. So, in fact, the threat from drones is very broad. It not only is used to deliver weapons on the battlefield, but it's actually been used by criminal enterprise, for example, Mexican drug cartels, to deliver bombs. And to that dual nature of this technology, we hear a lot about the promise of drones delivering packages. Well, you can imagine the capability to deliver your latest, you know, package from Amazon could be much more sinister. But the truth is that threat that comes from what we would call kinetic delivery is actually just the beginning of the whole profile of capabilities that drones deliver. So that surveillance capability that we use on the battlefield is also used in industrial settings to inspect our critical infrastructure, such as the grid. It's used to inventory and assess our agricultural production. It's used to inspect critical infrastructure, such as manufacturing facilities. And all of these go to the larger point that drone technology is really the nexus of a lot of different technological innovations. So it's a center point for material science. It's a center point for high power, high efficiency battery technology. And perhaps most importantly, it's a center point for computing and communications, and especially for artificial intelligence. So drones really are a threat not only from what they can do, but as an adversarial technology that has that dual use, when we have competitors who are able to get ahead of us in new technology areas, it really has a broad range of impacts to our capabilities.
Let me ask you about one other piece of this, John, because you mentioned the kinds of applications that drones can be put to for commercial purposes, and for that matter, you know, individuals' recreational interests and the like. The concern is that if DJI, this Chinese company, which now dominates this market thanks to the Made in China 2025 campaign, that information is available to China as well as the user, is it not? And give us some sense of what the implications of that might be.
Well, that is indeed the case. And unfortunately, our regulatory approach to drones is actually aiding in the ability of China to aggregate that kind of information. So, for example, domestically, the FAA has implemented a system that requires drone operators to request authorization when they're flying, for example, near a major airport. And of course, that would on the face of it be a rather sensible piece of regulation, especially, you know, from what we've seen with an incident in the UK. But unfortunately, our implementation of this has allowed a company like DJI to require that its users essentially dial home to China to let them know just when and where they're flying. And so not only is there the well-established threat proven by previous breaches showing that DJI was collecting and storing video, including sensitive military operations, on publicly available servers. But also now they can actually look and be required under the regulatory regime to collect information about all of the type of drone operations that are being conducted across the United States.
Now, when you say the regulatory regime, are you talking about the Chinese regulatory regime, or are you talking about the U.S. regulatory regime?
Well, I'm disappointed to say it's the U.S. regulatory regime. So, you know, I think the reality is that security, you know, with respect to the production and supply chain for drone technology, the control of exports of sensitive military technology, and even the domestic airspace regulations have all been heavily influenced, you know, to allow Chinese industry to gain control of our own.
Knowing what you do about both this industry and the role that the Chinese are playing in it now, and the degree to which they have penetrated our government and regulatory decisions, what would you do at this point to try to, you know, protect, well, individual personal data and privacy as well as the national security?
Well, I think that's unfortunately not a simple answer to that. The reality is we have given China the lead in the technology. Most industry analysts put them something like 2 years ahead of American industry in terms of technological capability for these types of systems. You know, where our regulatory agencies are still struggling with basic ideas of allowing commercial operations, again, in the Chinese market in their own country, they are able to use them for things like firefighting. I mean, you know, sort of the possibilities of what this technology is capable of, they're pushing forward much faster than we are. So I unfortunately don't think it's a simple answer. I think certainly the keys are that the U.S. Policy needs to be in line with the Defense Production Act determination that we have a real investment in the domestic industry, and that can be for both civil and military purposes. We need to reform the regulatory approach, so we need to remove the influence of the Chinese lobby on our regulatory development and move forward quickly with sensible and safe regulations. And finally, we need to have the support of the public in understanding the risks of these systems. So, you know, I think that there's been the idea that if you find the drone under the Christmas tree, it can't be so bad. And what's the harm, right, in buying that Chinese drone? But the reality is that the threats are real and pervasive.
This is a topic to which I think we best return with you soon, John. I'm so grateful for your time today and for the opportunity to sort of raise awareness about what's really going on here. John Perry, thank you for your service. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with a terrific investigative reporter, Claudia Rosette, on why we are all Hong Kongers now. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by the extraordinarily important investigative reporter, Claudia Rosette, a recognized and highly accomplished monitor of some of the most important stories of our time, notably through her past roles as a reporter on the United Nations in Russia, then the Soviet Union and China. She has been breaking stories that are of extraordinary and enduring importance, and I'm privileged to call her a friend as well as one of my most admired colleagues. She's a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum these days, as well as the author of The Rosette Report at PJ Media. We're always privileged to have her with us. Claudia Rosette, welcome back. I wanted to really commend you for and call attention to a piece that you had at IWF.org, the Independent Women's Forum site, entitled We Are All Hong Kongers Now. This is a theme that I think you have long expressed in various ways, but give us a flavor of why it's so true today as we're witnessing what China is doing, the Chinese Communist Party, that is doing to Hong Kong, and what it means for the rest of us as well as the people there.
What the Chinese Communist Party is doing in Hong Kong is striving to eliminate the freedoms that make a free society. It is destroying a free society. And it has a lot to do with us because that is the Communist Party's approach to free societies generally. And part of what's happened in Hong Kong is the national security law, as it's called, that China imposed on Hong Kong, and the sort of just before midnight on June 30th, just before the anniversary of the 1997 handover, includes articles in which China claims that it can, it has basically, it targets as criminals people who in any way are, it judges to have broken this law, no matter where they are in the world. In other words, it's not just in Hong Kong. They're effectively saying, even though they can't enforce it in some places, we have jurisdiction anywhere. And specifically, they issued arrest warrants some weeks ago for a number of people they were accusing of having violated the national security law they've imposed on Hong Kong. And among them was an American citizen, a naturalized American citizen, whose activities regarding Hong Kong have been to lobby the American government, his own government, because he was born in Hong Kong but naturalized here. He's been a citizen for more than two decades. They accused him of having violated their national security law by doing this. In other words, an American citizen who lobbied his own government to try to, what was he lobbying the government for here? To try and support what Hong Kong's people were asking for. Let me be more direct about this. China, in the handover of Hong Kong in 1997, promised under treaty with Britain that Hong Kong for 50 years would enjoy its customs, rights, and freedoms, that, and this is sort of the same way of life. That is being completely violated. This was an American who was lobbying for America to pressure China to honor its treaty, to uphold that and respect Hong Kong's freedoms, at least through 2047, as they promised. For that, an arrest warrant was issued for him in Hong Kong.
I wanted to ask you a question, Claudia. You said that they cannot enforce these warrants and other diktats from Beijing elsewhere around the world, but we have seen signs of Chinese government agencies acting extraterritorially, typically against Chinese nationals, to be sure. But even in the United States, we've had students on campuses, we've had individuals who are, you know, coming to campus to speak against China, where there's a Confucius Institute operation.
Yeah, what we've actually been seeing, okay, here's how it really works around the world. They were engaging, even in Hong Kong, even before this so-called that. I'm saying so-called law because it's more a template for repression for the same system that they have in China than what we regard as a law. But before this national security law, they were already doing things like kidnap. They kidnapped a number of booksellers in Hong Kong who were selling books involving gossip about China's dictator, Xi Jinping. They have, as you say, they have an enormous network of people spying on each other for them among students overseas, among anyone from China who's overseas, basically. We've seen people now trying to leave Hong Kong for Taiwan arrested. In other words, the beginning of, are we about to see sort of a 21st century version of an attempted boat people exodus from Hong Kong, which they will not tolerate. And basically, in a whole set of institutions, within institutions such as, say, the United Nations, this great attempt to change the norms and the standards by which we operate in the modern world, they cannot actually officially come and arrest an American citizen who they say has broken their law. But what people now have to worry about is if they go to a country, because the U.S., President Trump got rid of America's extradition treaty with Hong Kong. Otherwise, until very recently, we had an extradition treaty with them. Now, this is so bad that the Trump administration said, we're not going to allow Americans to be extradited to Hong Kong. Effectively, it's being extradited to China. But if you travel to countries that still honor extradition treaties with Hong Kong, then anyone they are looking for is potentially at risk. So this is classic Communist Party bullying and threats and intimidation, Frank. It's that you don't quite know exactly where that line might be, but it's this vastly extended threat intended to shape behavior.
Claudia, let me ask you about one individual who has become among the most prominent of those who are being persecuted by the Chinese Communist Party at the moment, namely Jimmy Lai. When we last talked, you were quite concerned that he had just been arrested, as I recall. He was freed on bail. He has quite courageously been still vocal in the press, notably our friend Maria Bartiromo has had him on twice that I know of to sort of showcase his courage and the importance of extending kind of protection to him by raising his profile. But there are lots of others that you know well who are not as prominent and who are also in jeopardy now. And give us some of the names of the people that you're particularly concerned about at the moment at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party.
Okay, well, these are people who have sort of made their stand because the problem now has indeed become, as in China, do you name people? Do you call attention to them? Because doing so puts them at risk. One of the awful effects of this law is where you could normally, you know, until this happened, you could speak freely about people who were there. They could speak out pretty freely. And, you know, it was what we regard as civilized free discourse. Now anyone who has the spotlight turned on him is at risk. But there are people who have already made themselves so prominent, sort of made their decisions. There are people like Martin Lee, who's known as the godfather, he likes to call himself the uncle of Hong Kong democracy, who has been a voice for Hong Kong's rights and freedoms for democracy there since going back to at least the 1980s, who has sort of walked this long, long road making these incredibly eloquent arguments. There are people like, you know, one of the more famous, well-known around the world, Joshua Wong, who founded a party, a political party. He was critical in the Umbrella Movement of 2014. He's already been charged. He's probably facing more jail time. He's already done prison time, but who keeps speaking out. There are quite a number of people. Without going into names, let me just say that in the legislature, there's a lineup in the sort of rigged legislature among the minority because they make sure that they can't get him. The system makes sure they can't get a majority. China makes sure they can't and has now postponed elections for a year. There are some amazing, courageous lawmakers who have continued to speak out.
Claudia, thank you for this reporting on the drama that is playing out on our watch as a frontline part of the free world is inexorably reduced to another enslaved population of the Chinese Communist Party. It's heartbreaking, but your clarity about what's going on here is so valuable, and we appreciate it. Come back to us again, sir, with updates if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.